Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
You may be seated. Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 25th, 2023. I just mentioned that because we are recording the oral arguments here today. So I want to make that clear for the record. The recording will be available on our website within the next 24 hours or so. We'll just take a minute to get settled here, and then I will call the first case. Well, I am Judge Cochran. I'm the presiding judge today, and with me are Chief Judge Siegel and Judge Wheelock. The first case on our calendar today is A22-1301, Lisa Smitkamp, now known as Lisa Ann Brady, versus David Jules Smitkamp. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and then appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a podium, as you can see, that's it's adjustable, and there's also a timer on the podium, so you can see how much time you have remaining in your argument. I'll just ask that at the start of your argument, you identify yourself and the party you represent, and also let us know if you have any preference for how we refer to you during the oral argument today. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. It truly is a great honor and privilege to stand before you. As everyone knows, it's very rare for attorneys to get to this level and do appellate work. So I thank you sincerely for your time and patience and kindness with this case. My name is Rich Hechter, H-E-C-H-T-E-R. I'd say you can call me Rich, but I guess we gotta be formal, so you can call me Mr. Hechter. And I represent David Smitkamp, who is the appellant, the moving party in this situation. Your Honor, I believe this case is highly fact-dependent, especially for the issues that we raise on appeal. I wanna emphasize is, and again, I've been practicing law since 1989, and this divorce case moved probably 99% faster than most. The parties separated in March of 2021. The summons and petition was filed in May of 2021. There was an ICMC, Initial Case Management Conference, in June of 2021. Shortly thereafter, within probably 60, 70 days, the parties stipulated and agreed to bifurcate the case and allow Ms. Smitkamp, she has a different name now, allow Ms. Smitkamp to obtain that decree of dissolution, and the parties had two material, valuable homes in Mesa, Arizona. Mr. Smitkamp had some problems with the community, the association where the park was, so he was basically trespassed from that, but to make the divorce move and go easy to get those homes sold, Mr. Smitkamp immediately agreed to allow the homes to be solely in appellees, Ms. Smitkamp's name, and he executed whatever deeds there were or whatever transfer documents. Then the agreement was the proceeds from the sale would be placed in Mr. Carlson's trust account.
Counsel?
Yes.
I understand you want to talk about the substantive issues here, but I wonder if you could first address for us the issue of whether or not the appeal is in its entirety is premature.
Yes, I know this question was coming, so I thank the court for the heads up and the clerk. I do not believe so. The judgment and decree, which was entered essentially immediately without delay, was issued in, I believe it was July of 2022. That was a final appealable order.
Counsel, yeah. You say it's final and appealable, but when I look at the order, on page 28 in paragraph 10, it notes that with regard to attorney's fees, that petitioner is entitled to an award of conduct-based attorney's fees and costs. By August 12, 2022, counsel for respondent shall file an affidavit setting forth the attorney's fees sought as a result of respondent's conduct identified previously. So that, it appears to me that there isn't a final decision in this judgment and decree as to attorney's fees. Would you agree with that?
Well, I agree partly with the Court of Appeals. There hasn't been finality, and for whatever it's worth, the court below, no one ever scheduled any kind of hearing or set a specific motion. The problem that appellant has is that, and compared to Barch and the other cases, this request for attorney's fees was asked for like literally the day of trial. There was no notice, no due process, no opportunity to respond. It was not a separate proceeding, unlike Barsh or the other cases. There was no separate proceeding or separate motion to obtain attorney's fees, like in the Barsh case. What happened, I believe, is that the appellant was trying to enforce a judgment and decree that had been entered literally 4 years prior to a new motion being filed. I think the JD was in 2012. I'm going from memory. In 2016, one of the parties brought a motion seeking to enforce the judgment and decree. It was a separate proceeding. Literally, basically a separate claim with that. And so it was separate trying to enforce attorney's fees. And I think it's distinguishable because here there really was no proper motion. As I put in my appellate brief, there was no meet and confer. There was no opportunity to resolve this. Opposing counsel, appellee's counsel, never before the trial brought any kind of motion to enforce or compel discovery. It was really kind of a sandbag moment, and it was part of the case. And if you look at the strong case law, in order to even get to an award of conduct-based attorney's fees, the trial court, the court below, has to make very, very specific findings in terms of, you know, how, if any, Mr. Smitkamp delayed the litigation, how, if any, he intended to dissipate assets at the time of the divorce while it's pending or in specific contemplation of the divorce. In our particular case, the assets that appellee brings up, like a truck and other things, that was all handled during the marriage long before there was a filing of the summons and petition, and there was no evidence that the parties discussed divorce before that. So I would respectfully submit that the trial court just really, and I say this with the utmost respect, you know, really committed error, really committed an abuse of discretion. And candidly, I don't think she was biased. I think she was very prejudiced against my client because my client ended up moving to Africa during the pendency of the divorce to be a pastor at a church to help an orphanage. And there was testimony that Mr. Smitkamp gave a chunk of money to the orphanage. And I sincerely believe the trial court just thought, like, well, we're not going to award any assets to this guy because he's just going to give it to the orphanage, and that's improper. Well, it's not specifically spelled
out. Mr. Hatcher, I, you know, I appreciate that you've spent a lot of time briefing the issues here. But in if we were to conclude that the appeal was premature, it, the appeal could be brought again after there is a final judgment as that resolves the attorney fee issue.
Yes.
And in Berichtet, it says that the order was not final and appealable because the order does not fully determine respondent's separate claim for conduct-based attorney's fees. So that whole appeal was considered to be premature. Here, we do not have, the order doesn't fully determine the claim for attorney's fees, conduct-based attorney's fees here either. Is there any basis for saying, for us to conclude that the request for attorney's fees, conduct-based attorney's fees here is not a separate claim? I mean, that's, I understand the two cases are different in terms of how they arose procedurally, but I think the only way that we could conclude that we have a final judgment here is if somehow we were able to, final and appealable judgment, is if somehow we were able to conclude that the attorney's fee request is not a separate claim, based on my reading of Berisht.
Yes, I understand the options that the court has. You can remand it down for, you know, specific findings on, require the trial court to make very specific findings. So if the court is inclined to remand it down for a proceeding on the amount of attorney's fees, I would very, very respectfully ask the court to notify the trial court that it needs to make specific findings pursuant to all the case law that it is insufficient to make conclusory statements and just conclusory amounts of attorney's fees. In other words, just like affirming what the appellee is requesting. There's got to be very specific findings. Again, for judicial economy as well, Your Honors, I would say we should let the appeal hear. For whatever reason, the case was slated for mediation. The appellee's attorney didn't want to opt in for that mediation, which got us kind of a straight line here. Mr. Smitkamp will do whatever is reasonable and whatever the Court of Appeals would like him to do. I'll end it that way. But the reality is, we believe sincerely that there was much error and abuse of discretion and, frankly, prejudice and emotion and personal thought that went into the J&D. And we think it needs to be appealed, and the Court of Appeals needs to look at those issues of conduct-based attorney's fees and the division of assets. So I do leave it in your wise hands. Again, I would just simply say that I believe it is a final order. I do believe it is appealable. And I think this is very, very case specific as to how, again, look at how the attorney's fees issue was raised. No notice, no meeting conferred, no motion prior to that. All the other cases, it was basically briefed out. It was brought as a separate proceeding. The court clerk
is there, excuse me, Mr. Hatcher, is there any requirement in statute that there be a formal motion in order to request conduct-based attorney's fees?
It's a good question. I don't necessarily think there is. However, I think the special rules of court for civil procedure and the special rules of court, which encompass family court practice as well, and again, I'm talking about like rule 115.10 of the special rules of practice for litigation in all courts, requires that, number one, you got to make a good faith effort to try to resolve issues before you bring motions or sanctions for attorney's fees. This is a high argument, but again, I would respectfully submit that, you know, due process rights from the U.S. and state constitutions would also impose a duty to give notice and opportunity to be heard and let opposing counsel know, like, hey, we're bringing this motion for attorney's fees, and then have it on the record literally the day when the trial starts, without any real opportunity to respond. So for those reasons, I do think there is authority, whether it's the U.S. Constitution, the state constitution, the 14th Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, statutory and rule requirements, again, like 115.10 at SEC, that you have to give notice, it's got to be properly noticed, you have to have safe harbor, you have to have allow time for an attorney to correct anything, and none of that happened. It was just at the trial, appellee's counsel just said, hey, we're also going to ask for attorney's fees because Mr. Smitkamp did not comply with discovery. However, prior to, there was no motions and there were no orders, and Mr. Smitkamp felt that there was no compliance issues. So again, if you look at this case, which is very, very fact specific, I think that it is appealable and we don't need to adjudicate the amount of attorney's fees before it is. And that's all I have, Your Honor.
Any further questions from the panel? Okay, thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. My name is Katie Westby, last name W-E-S-T-B-Y. I'm here appearing on behalf of the respondent in this matter. The appellant has brought three issues before the court, and I will respond to the first issue as to whether or not the judgment and decree in this matter is final and whether the issues before the court are appealable or premature. I think it's important to correct the record. There was actually a motion for attorney's fees that was brought in this case on September 21st, 2021. A motion was filed, a notice of motion and motion pursuant to the Minnesota General Rules of Practice, wherein paragraph 6, we ask that awarding the petitioner conduct-based attorney's fees pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518.14. Thereafter, the parties did enter into an agreement, as the appellant indicated, which bifurcated and divorced the parties. And it was in that order that the court reserved the issue of conduct-based attorney's fees, and that is why it was a matter that was decided during the court trial. I have reviewed the cases provided by the Court of Appeals, and also a few other related cases. I recognize the similarities in particular with the Bartsch v. Bartsch case, and as it relates to specifically an award of conduct-based fees, and this court's holding that conduct-based fees is a separate claim. The cases or the facts in that case and this case are nearly the same. However, I think that there is one distinguishable, perhaps, factor that developed in our attempts to secure a judgment and decree with a monetary amount. Pursuant to the judgment and decree...
Just to clarify, after the district court issued its judgment and decree in the dissolution proceeding that included the attorney's fee language, it's my understanding that an affidavit was filed pursuant to the order, but there hasn't been any subsequent order issued by the district court on the attorney fee issue. Is that correct?
That is correct. On August 12th, we filed an affidavit of attorney's fees with the district court with the amount that we were seeking for an award. We didn't hear back, so on December 12th, approximately 4 months later, attorney from our office, James Carlson, contacted the district court inquiring about the status of the judgment. Counsel for the appellant objected to the correspondence, asserting that no additional ruling should be made as the matter was up for appeal. We never received a response from the district court, and therefore a judgment was never issued nor entered. Accordingly, the respondent was basically forced to respond to the merits of the appellant's brief, and that's why we filed our responsive brief as we did. The respondent has incurred significant attorney's fees. And it's our position, while the case law suggests that a separate claims would indicate that the appeal is premature, we are asking that the appeal actually proceed as we have detailed in our respective briefs. Dismissing or remanding this appeal would effectively double or maybe even greater Ms. Brady's attorney's fees. Additionally, this court has previously ruled that an appeal can proceed in the interests of judicial economy, and that's in Sheeran v. Sheeran. So we are asking that the court hear our arguments as it relates to the merits of the conduct-based attorney's fees, the merits as it relates to the dissipation of the marital assets, as well as the division of marital assets.
So, counsel, I fully understand your concerns about attorney's fees costs, and I'm sure appellant shares those same concerns, but our rules are clear that an appeal may only be taken from a final judgment or a partial judgment entered pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 54.02, and as based on my review of the record, there isn't a partial judgment here, and it doesn't under Barrett, it doesn't appear that we have a final judgment because the conduct-based attorney fee issue hasn't been decided. The Sheeran case that you're referring us to, did that involve conduct-based attorney fees?
Your Honor, I believe that the facts were different in that case. And so I do recognize appreciate that the facts in the Birch case is very similar to this case. Again, I think that the one fact that's different is that we sought that order from the district court, and I'm not here to speculate. I don't know why we didn't receive a response or why we haven't received a final judgment. Perhaps it was over the objection of the appellant that the court was actually precluded from issuing that judgment since the matter had already been appealed. So it just put the respondent in a precarious situation, and that's why we're asking that the court, in the alternative, hears the merits as it relates to the dissipation of assets or the division of the marital estate.
So do you think it matters that Barrett was an appeal from a motion to enforce a judgment as opposed to the appeal here where the judgment and decree, it's direct appeal from the judgment and decree, leaving open the amount of the conduct-based attorney's fees.
I do think there's some significance in the procedural posture in that Birch was from a post-decree and this is from the initial determination. And I think that is suggestive that the appeal could move forward without there being any prejudice as it relates to the other two issues that are up for appeal. As it relates to the merits of the conduct-based attorney's fees, the district court did not abuse its discretion in awarding those fees. The district court made detailed findings as to the award and found that the award was appropriate because the appellant took a disingenuous position. The appellant did that as it related to his claim for spousal maintenance. He originally requested temporary spousal maintenance. Later, he provided in a trial proposed judgment and decree that he was in reasonable health, capable to work, had no disabilities, and was no longer seeking spousal maintenance. However, at the court trial, he changed his mind and then decided to request temporary spousal maintenance again. The respondent had to fully respond in all aspects, inquiring attorney's fees, preparing testimony, preparing necessary exhibits for a claim of spousal maintenance, which included a detailed monthly budget, supporting documents. She also incurred fees as it related to the analysis in our post-trial drafting. It's important to also note that the appellant provided no documentation to support his claim for spousal maintenance. He provided no monthly budget, no supporting documents of his monthly budget, no proof of income, and no proof of any inability to work. He simply requested it at the trial and nothing but his testimony. He also failed to produce any documentation during the divorce proceedings. He didn't.
Which, you know, the district court's order simply says petitioner is entitled to an award of conduct-based attorney's fees and costs and doesn't provide any real explanation or support for the reasoning behind that. In that paragraph, which findings are you, would you point us to support your argument?
Sure. On page 23 of the judgment and decree, the court sets forth our request for the conduct-based attorney's fees. The court cites the appropriate statute and indicates that...
Great. That's very helpful.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure I was tracking on the same parts of the order as you were.
Oh, good. So, okay. And it continues on through page, the entirety of page 24 as well.
Yeah.
So there was a problem here with the production of documents. We served him on November.
Was there a motion to compel made? Just did you make a motion to compel?
We didn't, Your Honor. As kind of the appellant has iterated, I don't think that this case was necessarily the longest case that a divorce had, but it was perhaps a very intense period of time from the time when the parties separated to having to file the divorce. And while a stipulation to bifurcate and perhaps agree on other terms may seem as though the proceeding is going in a amicable way, in fact, it was quite litigious. There were a lot of things that had happened kind of between counsel and the parties, and so there was a lot of fees that were expended during this time. There was also some conflicts as it related to some criminal matters, and so there was just perhaps lack of opportunity to file a motion to compel. The matter was actually set for court trial much sooner, but due to a personal situation in our office, it was continued further out due to a health concern. And so no motion to...
With the 4 minutes you have left, can you address the dissipation?
I can.
Issue?
Yes. So we believe that the district court did not err in finding that the appellant dissipated several of the marital assets. We believe that the dissipation occurred in contemplation of the divorce or during the divorce. And the district court specifically found that. So the district court analyzed the assets that were in the appellant's possession at the time that the parties separated. And on page 5 of the appellant's proposed judgment and decree, he actually acquiesced and states that the following assets were in his possession: a truck, the Thrivent account, and his art collection.
Right, but then he testified at least that some of it was used for his living expenses. So, and I know some of it was a donation to an orphanage or something. So should the court have parsed those apart based on, you know, whose burden it was to prove dissipation?
I don't believe that the district court found him credible in that testimony. I think it's also notable and problematic that he provided no documentation to corroborate his testimony that he had to use these funds for necessary living expenses. He provided no bank statements.
But counsel, you'd agree that the burden of proof with regard to dissipation is on wife in this case.
I do, Your Honor. And again, leads me to the problem that he provided no documentation for us to be able to provide to the court that certain assets were either cashed in or sold and he used those funds for perhaps living expenses. There was also testimony that he had perhaps minimal living expenses. At times he had rent free. He also was living in sober housing, and so he didn't prove that he actually had any reasonable living expenses that he had to use those funds for.
Did wife provide sufficient evidence to support that they did not go toward the funds that he received from disposing of the assets did not go towards his living expenses?
I believe that in totality, if we look at the amount that we believe was dissipated, It's over $200,000, and this is from a time period of March of 2021 until probably June of 2021. That's a significant amount of money that would just go towards his reasonable living expenses. It's also noteworthy that the respondent was the one that paid for all of the expenses that were incurred having to move the parties from Arizona to Minnesota. That was with regard to obtaining pods, moving furniture, with regard to legal expenses. And so she took a burden of those expenses, and she was did prove that through her bank statements and through her credible testimony as well. I think the last that I would note as it relates to the dissipation of assets is that the district court did not consider any marital misconduct. In fact, the judgment and decree indicates that in multiple statements. And also, I think it's important that, in fact, the transcript would demonstrate that the district court limited testimony as it related to any of the egregious conduct of the appellant, so to make sure that the record was clear that that conduct was not considered in the division of the marital assets. For those reasons, we would ask that the relief sought by the appellant be denied and that the judgment and decree as ordered remain. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, if I may, and please, as counsel. Real quickly, two things. It's uncontroverted, undisputed that the parties bought two properties here in Minnesota. They sold them, and I believe in 2019, they moved to Mesa, Arizona. While there, they bought two, they call them park homes, like pre-made park homes, and you buy the home, but you pay lot lease. When they got to Arizona, prior to that, both parties testified everything was 50-50 in terms of paying bills and expenses. When they got to Arizona, it's uncontroverted that the appellee, Mrs. Smitkamp, was earning $120,000 a year working at her job. Appellant, Mr. Smitkamp, literally had no income. From basically 2019, 2020, until they moved back to Minnesota, appellant bartended, and he worked like art fairs. Like an example would be the Minneapolis Art Fair or the.
So what difference does that make in terms of the legal issues raised here on appeal?
Well, because it goes to the issue opposing counsel mentioned, a claim for alimony. Temporary spousal maintenance, which we asked for $500 a month for 1 year. And that's because during the course of living in Arizona for the approximate 2+ years, appellant had really no income, and he relied on Ms. Smitkamp to pay everything, which included his insurance. It included their living expenses. He was basically in the same situation as a stay-at-home mom, if you want to look at claims and factors.
But didn't the court also find that he was unemployed? I mean, that's backward-looking, but the court made a finding that he was under or just plain old unemployed voluntarily, correct?
I believe, yes. I believe there was a finding, but that doesn't substantiate the right of appellant to seek temporary spousal maintenance in a case, $500 a month, when he's used to having his insurance covered and paid 100% by the spouse and all other expenses for the years basically moving from Minnesota to
Mesa. You're trying to justify the temporary spousal. You're talking about the
conduct-based.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's more than a sufficient factual basis. If the genders were reversed and we had a husband making 120 and the wife is pretty much working part-time, taking care of the house, bartending, and trying to do art fairs, I don't think anyone would bat an eye. It's a long-term, they were married for about 11 years.
Well, but that's not really the case law, though, either. I mean, it's kind of a long-term, I mean, the cases on this issue look at many more than the prior year or two, correct?
Yeah, well, you look at the totality, but you also have to look at the current situation and, again, length of marriage, a discrepancy in income, which is a big one, ability to rehabilitate the underprivileged spouse and get work, again, the standard of living that the parties were used to. Yes, there's a whole statutory list of factors, and it's case by case. I just brought this up because opposing counsel thought that was the basis for one of the basis for conduct-based fees, because he made a claim for 1 year temporary spousal maintenance for $500 under the fact that the wife paid for everything. He literally had no stable job or income, and there was $800,000, at least appellant believed there was $800,000 in marital assets, mostly assets of the wife. When the wife came into the marriage, she had gone through personal bankruptcy and had $4,800 of assets. So when they got married, what the wife brought in was uncontroverted, was $4,800. At the time they started the divorce proceeding, they had literally about $800,000 in assets. The vast majority were controlled by appellee. So if you look at all those factors, I think asking during the case here or there, submitting a request for temporary spousal maintenance, rehabilitative maintenance for 1 year and $500, because I think that's important for the court, the minimal amount, and it was just to get Mr. Smitkamp, to time for insurance and whatnot. Real quickly, opposing counsel brought me in and said there was some situations with me and Mr. Carlson. I don't think we ever had, I thought Ms. Westby made some comment that there was problems with counsel. I've worked very well with Carlson. I had a mental block. Very nice gentleman. We've had many conversations. Many of them contained a lot of levity. You can ask him, but I don't think there was any contention. He had problems with my client, and I totally agree and admit to that. And
counsel, I appreciate your comments about your getting along with Mr. Carlson, but your time is up, so if you could briefly conclude, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. So again, it's an honor and privilege to be here. Opposing counsel has absolutely no objection to the court, you know, taking the whole appeal on the merits. That's what we want. So there's stipulated agreement right now on the record that the court should look at this case without remanding it back down and make decisions on the merits for all the issues briefed. And I thank you for everyone's time and attention, so thank you.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.